From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The battle cries of free trade and fair trade are sounding once again as the WTO meets in Cancun, and Americans feel the chill of global competition and unemployment at home. Tonight on Point, resurgent debate over the truth and consequences of global trade. We begin in Cancun, where 146 ministers are set to begin WTO talks tomorrow. John Authors, economics correspondent for the Financial Times, is covering the meetings. I asked him what's at stake for the countries involved.
Quite a lot, although exactly what's online depends on who you're talking to. The main agenda being driven by the more powerful countries in the WTO is to continue to expand its remit and broaden and deepen, as they would see it, the rules governing free trade. And as far as the protesters and the various anti-globalization groups who are here are concerned, they're trying to extend their remit even further beyond areas where they have no business to be. It's very unlikely that we'll see any precise deals this week, but the WTO would probably regard it as a success merely if they can agree to keep talking. And for the protesters outside, a victory would consist in getting the main governments to admit that they can't agree.
These big meetings have come to be magnets for protest and for debate around globalization and, of course, for all the issues that sit around trade and tariffs. Of course, there were the big mob scenes in Seattle, meeting before last, then Doha in Qatar. And the sense that there has not been much progress since Doha, that things are kind of dead in the water here, is there a fear that the world is actually backpedaling on a commitment to free trade?
Again, obviously, it depends on who you're talking to. I'm actually talking to you from a forum being held by the anti-globalization people where they would almost call it a hope that that is happening. Mm-hmm. And yes, there's a great fear that that's happening in the conference center itself. I think the single most important issue is agriculture, not surprisingly, because we're in Mexico, where there are a lot of small farmers and where they've had the effect of NAFTA for several years. The Mexican farming lobbies, or the Mexican peasants, are here in very great numbers and are very angry about what they see as the negative effects that free trade has had upon them. And the arguments being made against them are that it's because they haven't made themselves efficient, they haven't prepared themselves for free trade, that they are now finding it impossible or at least very, very difficult to compete against U.S. imports.
But isn't it the case, John, that European and American agriculture are the most heavily subsidized agricultural industries in the world?
I believe that's true, and certainly part of the agenda that the governments of the developing countries, talking about the likes of Mexico, Brazil, India, China, the agenda that they are trying to develop against the European Union and the US is that, yes, they want to carry on with the WTO. They're not saying they're against globalization in the way that many of the protesters are, but that they are now taking quite a strong and organized stand, saying that there has to be an emphasis on reducing and ultimately eliminating subsidies. Both the Common Agricultural Policy and the U.S. Farm Bill, they would say, are examples of protection, of inhibition on free trade by another name. One of the more interesting developments coming before Cancun is that group of the more economically powerful or the bigger non-rich countries like Brazil and India are now actually forming a bloc and trying to work together.
And what do the Americans and Europeans say to the criticism that they're themselves some of the biggest offenders on subsidies? How do they promote free trade and keep the subsidies up at the same time in this conversation?
With difficulty. I think one key point that they would make is that it's important for the poorer countries to get their houses in order to make their agricultural systems efficient, and that they are doing things that are within the rules of the WTO at present.
So it's about the rules of the game and efficiency. There'll be a lot on the agricultural side of the debate around trade. What about the anti-globalization crowd? Have they managed to show up in Cancun in strength? And what's the message that they're carrying to this meeting?
They're here, all right. They're predominantly led by Mexicans for obvious reasons. This is very convenient for Mexicans to get to, and because there's a lot of Mexicans who feel strongly about NAFTA. generally what they're hoping for is, the word that's being used is derailment. They're hoping that the governments involved at the WTO will agree by the end of this week that they can't agree, and they're hoping that that will lead to the formation of some slightly different system that is more to their liking. I've heard many of the anti-globalization protesters today talking about the development of a number of different regional trade blocks who might then, having done something that they are comfortable with in their interest, start dealing with other regional trade blocks and have something which, as far as they would say, is built from the ground up based on the needs of the poorer countries rather than imposed from the top down by the richer ones.
Of course, the Doha round was supposed to encourage that, but we can hear resistance or rejection of that right there. What about the scene in Cancun, John Authors? It's not the most accessible place in the world and fairly easily controlled. Are the protests and what's the security outlook there?
Well, it's fascinating. Yes, you're quite right. The design of the resort is almost perfect for the police, because most of the nicest hotels in Cancun are on a very long, you know, more than 20-mile long sand strip. It's not unlike Miami, I guess.
Separated from the mainland by water itself.
Yes, and there are only two access roads to the strip, both of which have barricades across them, which to get to the anti-globalization forum I'm at the moment, I needed to go through four roadblocks. Tomorrow, when the first main demonstration is expected, it's likely that there'll be very much stronger roadblocks. I mean, the really surreal thing, as I speak, I'm looking out over palm trees in the Caribbean, and just around the corner of the bay, there are warships protecting the delegates against the possibility of terrorism.
Mexican warships, I assume.
Yes, but it's a very surreal sight that there are people swimming, there are people doing their jet skis, and beyond that, there are somewhat sinister-looking warships with their guns facing out into the Caribbean.
John Authors, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
John Authors covers economic issues for the Financial Times. He spoke with me from Cancun, Mexico. During the explosive economic growth of the 1990s, it was easy to see a rising tide lifting all boats. Yes, anti-globalization protesters marched on Seattle, but most Americans bought the free trade formula. Let each nation do what it does best and all will prosper. Fast forward to 2003, and there's some wavering in the air. If everyone from IBM to textile mills ships jobs overseas, what is left for American workers? If jobs chase low wages, does everyone end up poor? It's time to fire up the conversation again as we head into a campaign year that is sure to revisit free trade and fair trade and all the messiness in between. Are you still on the free trade bandwagon, or are you running from free trade, running for your job, afraid for your standard of living? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and co-author of What the Experts Got Wrong About the Global Economy. Good evening and welcome, Mark Weisbrot.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from New York is Jagdish Bhagwati, professor of economics and political science at Columbia University. He is author of many books, including Free Trade Now and Protectionism. Good evening and welcome, Professor Bhagwati.
Yes, hello.
Thanks so much for being with us. Mark Weisbrot, to you first, if I may. In the Democratic presidential debate on Sunday night, the first of many, trade and free trade and the terms of free trade were very much on the table. We heard, in effect, calls for rewriting a lot of what was written in free trade agreements in the 1990s and even earlier. Is there a new understanding of free trade, of fair trade, of what works for rich and poor nations? You heard the term derailment being put forward by protesters in Cancun. Is there an effort to derail what's been understood as free trade and an engine of prosperity?
Well, I think there always has been. If you remember that President Clinton couldn't even, after campaigning for many months, 6 to 8 hours a day, and making it his major priority, in 1992, he couldn't even get a majority of his own party to vote for the North American Free Trade Agreement. So it's just kind of been growing. I mean, that was just the first agreement that the public had any awareness of. Prior to that, these things didn't really get out of the deep business pages. So this has been going on quite a long time. And I have to emphasize that these are not free trade agreements. I think it's literally inaccurate to refer to this as free trade, to the WTO as a free trade organization, to NAFTA as a free trade agreement. And perhaps Professor Bhagwati will agree with me on this, because one of the major objectives of this, of, say, the WTO, is to increase a very, very costly form of protectionism. So, in other words, they have one of their main goals, which they had to settle before this round at the end of August, is to try and enforce U.S.-style patent law around the world. This is protectionism. It's just like a tariff. You know, it's just like a tariff on a traded good. When you give a company a monopoly on a particular good and you allow them to charge a monopoly price, this is the same kind of inefficiency that economists are trying to eliminate.
So you're looking at the WTO and saying this is a lot of rules, but this isn't necessarily free trade. Professor Bhagwati, if I may turn to you, Mark Weisbord is quite right. There's been opposition and debate for years over this, but I'm hearing something new lately, and that is Americans listening to IBM executives talking about shipping jobs overseas, the big job losses of the last couple of years after the 90s boom, and people saying, my gosh, how can we compete? We know that we're getting our blue jeans at record low prices at Walmart, but on the other hand, how do you sustain an American jobs economy with this kind of free trade? Are the basics of this argument timeless, or is something changing here?
I don't think very much is changing. I think we heard the same talk. Remember when Ross Perot was worried about NAFTA, that all the jobs would be sucked out? Well, they really weren't. I think the fear is legitimate. You know, when you see people actually leaving, you don't think in terms of people actually arriving, for instance. Like, you know, the famous example of Route 95 along North Carolina, which is now, you know, where a lot of textile jobs were lost, but the whole, you know, the whole area has been replaced with German investments, and the route is now called Autobahn, and many of the workers were, in fact, in favor of foreign investment. So I think if you look at both sides of the street, you know, both inflows and outflows, you get a different picture. Two, I think there's a substantial amount of productivity change which has been going on, which due to technical change and just investment. And if you look at the output per man, that has continued to increase, as Mark will agree. And I think I've seen the calculations which show that of the millions of jobs which, you know, we fear we have lost to China and other places, only about 500,000 remain to be explained outside of productivity effects, you see. So if you were to have the same man-to-spade or man-to-machine ratio, for example, you would have had many more jobs. So I think manufacturing, to some extent, around the world is contracting, as it has been for many, many, you know, at least two decades now, purely because of the
of productivity. You're saying, Mark Weisbord, let me put that to you
Not entirely, but largely.
Yes, Mark Weisbord, do you see job loss coming out of the flight of jobs to China, to India, to Indonesia, to Bangladesh, job loss and lower wages or not?
The lower wages is the biggest and most obvious thing. The job loss is more complicated because we, you know, the total number of jobs depends much more on our overall economic policies, like the Federal Reserve's interest rate policy. You know, that's one of the reasons we had that long boom in the 90s, is because
low
the
rates.
Federal Reserve allowed the economy to grow, which they never had done before to that degree. And so the job question is more complicated. But nonetheless, we do lose a lot of manufacturing jobs. A lot of those are good-paying jobs, and they're being replaced by service sector jobs that are lower-paying. And that's one of the main reasons, I think, that and the downward pressure that this puts on wages, when employers can just say, we can go to China if we want and pay people 25 cents an hour and no benefits and no unions. And so this is what's really hurt. And if you look at the statistics, there's absolutely no ambiguity. I mean, for 30, you look at the last 30 years now in the United
States. We've got to take a short break. We'll come back and look at those, Mike Weisbord. Hang on to that thought. Mark Weisbord, Jagdish Bhagwati, we're talking tonight about the battle cries of free trade and fair trade and a resurgent debate over the truth and consequences of global trade. Are you still on the free trade bandwagon? Do you believe in the blessings of free trade? Do you see them in your life and work? Or are you running from free trade, running for your job? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the battle cries of free trade and fair trade and a resurgent debate over the truth and consequences of global trade. My guests tonight are Professor Jagdish Bhagwati, Professor of Economics and Political Science at Columbia University, joining us from New York. And from Washington, Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You can join the conversation as well. Are you still embracing free trade, or are you running from free trade? Are you running for your job? Are you losing the faith? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mark Weisbrot, you were saying that the numbers tell a clear story around wages. What is that story?
Very clear. In the last 30 years, the median wage in this country has hardly grown. It's grown about 7%. That's the middle, the wage right in the middle of the distribution. Now, if you look at the first half of the post-World War II period, from 1946 to 73, it grew by 80%. That's just a huge difference. This is the most massive redistribution of income in American history, and there's no doubt among economists that trade has played a role in, and the way in which we've opened up to trade has played a role in this. Now, they could argue about how much, but no matter how you slice it, those cheap blue jeans that you get at Walmart do not make up for most of the labor force, for 70% or more of the labor force. The cheaper goods have not made up for the downward pressure on people's wages.
Jagdish Bhagwati, help us cut into all this, because you know the kind of concern and fear that comes when unemployment grows. And free trade is often a target. Mark Weisbrot even debates whether it is free trade. But the kind of thing we're hearing now, which sounds a bit new to my ear, anyway, even hearing it in the presidential debate, is the United States cannot compete with other nations who don't have a minimum wage, who don't have labor or work conditions, kind of OSHA standards, who don't have environmental standards put on their industry, and that the U.S. needs to argue for a fresh floor under global industry that would insist on, I guess, fair trade means other countries having some kind of standards as well, so it's not a race to the bottom. Bring your economic analysis into this question for us.
Well, the economic analysis is probably best understood with two arguments. One is people in the poor countries could very well look at us and say, look, your workers are working with advanced machinery, with lots of capital equipment, and so on, and therefore that is unfair trade, because, you know, we are, mm-hmm. it's like sort of, you know, a handicapped person challenging, you know, Schwarzenegger.
Somebody on steroids,
right.
Yeah.
So the answer is that it is possible to be misled by these kinds of comparisons, and it's just what we economists call looking at sort of comparative advantage. There's always something you can do better if you have the right exchange rate. Of course, if you've got a very a distorted exchange rate, your market may be open for a whole lot of imports and you can't export anything and you run into a balance of payments deficit.
Mm-hmm.
But short of that, you know, if you're managing your exchange rates properly and your macroeconomic policy properly, then there's always something you will export and something you will import. So that's sort of the first answer to worrying mm-hmm. about, you know, other people having lower wages or having lower standards. The other thing, I think the concern about lower standards, I think, is we have to be a bit careful about that, because, you know, is it supposing we had in our own country a closed economy, okay, and then you were to put on higher standards for your labor, the labor intensive industries will certainly contract vis-a-vis the ones which are not using labor, right? And we don't complain about that. It's just part of it's the flip side of valuing your labor properly, you know, with respect and dignity which your country requires. If another country has a rather different attitude to it, whatever the reason, I'm not talking of dictatorships and so on, you
mm-hmm.
know. I mean, that's a different. But if it's a democratic country, there's a democratic process by which they have arrived at, you know, whatever labor conditions which they think are proper.
And they might look lousy to American eyes.
Yeah, and then, you see, we want to eat our cake and have it, because if that is so, we're going to have to compete with that, just as our labor-intensive industries would have had to compete with our capital-intensive industries in my previous example without any international trade. And so we would have to contract a little bit. I think our unions are really concerned about that competition aspect. I have no doubt about that. And I think they would like to say, look, rather than use protection, because that's one way of saying, look, we can't compete with these guys. So we
in other words, tariffs, big tariffs.
Right. Mm-hmm. But another way to do it is to go, it's like if a bull is charging at you, you try and catch it by the horn, or you reach around the beast and try and break its charge by seizing it by the tail.
So you're saying this call for standards, for global standards, is a kind of backdoor protectionism? Is that your point?
It can be when you're worried about your jobs. And I mean, I know a lot of unions I've worked with, many Human Rights Watch, etc. There are lots of good-hearted people who really want to raise standards, quite regardless of competition. And that is a very different argument. And there, I think, many people feel today, and it's not a small number, and that's really where the debate is, whether we want to use trade sanctions, which, you know, if we go, take the matter into the WTO, Tom, that means automatically trade sanctions kick in, because it's the one organization which says if you don't follow the rules, a country can complain and take you to the court, to the dispute settlement, and then you will have to pay for it.
Well, we'll look at what's going on at the WTO, but let me put this basic question to you, Mark Weisbrot. Also, what about this notion of fair trade that says, hey, if we're going to compete and not have our labor force pushed into lousy conditions, then we have to insist on some fundamental standards that Indonesia and India and China have, environmental and labor standards that put a kind of fair and even humane base under this. Jagdish Bhagwati looks at that and sees, in many instances, a kind of backdoor protectionism. How do you see it?
No, I think it's essential, and it shows completely what this is really about. It's not really about free trade versus fair trade at all. It's about people writing rules. They're making rules for global commerce, not even so much trade as other, you know, as investment. I mean, one of the main goals of these agreements is to make it easier and more profitable for U.S. manufacturing corporations to go overseas, where they don't have to, not only don't have to pay a living wage, but they don't have to provide benefits, and they don't have to worry about environmental regulation. In the case of China, they don't have to worry about a union that has the right to strike or collectively bargain. So to leave this completely out of the agreement and say, our labor has to compete with workers who don't even have the right to organize, first of all, I mean, it's a terrible thing to do to anyone, and it also prevents the workers in the rest of the world from doing what our workers took a century to do, which is to capture some of those gains from productivity, to actually get something out of it for themselves. And the numbers I gave, you know, when I said this has been the most massive redistribution of income in history in the United States, and that has trade has something to do with it, I was not exaggerating. Anybody who lived through the, you know, who's old enough, any of your listeners who have lived through the 50s or the 60s or even into the 70s, know that it was possible during that time for a worker with one income to buy a house and raise a family and send their kids to college in many cases, and that's no longer possible. And a lot of that is a result of that redistribution, of which writing these agreements has played a very, very big part. They want to throw workers into brutal competition, but, you know, they don't do this with doctors, for example, or professionals. With a lot less trouble than they've spent on the WTO or the NAFTA, they could have licensing, standardized licensing requirements for professionals like doctors.
To let doctors flow right in from Pune and then see where we go. Jagdish Bhagwati, how about it? You hear the pushback there that it's not fair, that it does fuel a race to the bottom, that it Mark Weisbrot is even suggesting it's kind of rigged to favor capital over labor. How do you respond?
No, I don't think there is a race to the bottom. I mean, that is the fear. I agree with Mark. That's the fear. But I don't think it's a reality. I've been looking at, for instance, the garment industry, you know, which is just down the road from where I'm talking on the phone in Columbia, New York.
Yep.
The garment district has pretty awful conditions, as you know, but a lot of it is due to illegal labor working there, which is not able to assert its rights and so on.
Kind of sweatshops, even in New York.
It's a very competitive industry around the world. You know, there's hardly any profit to be made on a substantial scale, but nothing has happened to revise the standards downwards. I looked at the furniture firms, which were, you know, because they went across to maquiladoras, which are the, you know, across the border, across the Rio Grande, when NAFTA was being, you know, negotiated and so on in 73, right? Mm-hmm. And at that time, the GAO had a study of these firms. I called up the office of the lead paint people, you know, the restrictions, the right. regulators, because that's what they were supposed to be fleeing from, because the Salinas, Mexico did not have the standards. Mm-hmm. It turned out that, I mean, the people in charge said, you know, we haven't revised any standards down at all. you know, if firms want to go, so be it. So I think we have the fear that if some firms leave, or if the competition is really intense, that we will revise our standards down. And I think the reason why I disagree with Mark on this is that I think precisely because of what he said, namely decades of fighting on the part of the unions and, you know, our transformation as a decent society supporting mm-hmm. these standards at home, we are not going to give them up. And instead, what the politics is turning into is to say, look, we won't lower our standards to be able to compete, but we'll just force the standards up elsewhere.
Well, if you, as an American worker, that doesn't sound so bad, does it?
No, it doesn't. And actually, it puts some pressure. And I think the best way to do the pressure is not through sanctions, because do we like sanctions? Nobody likes sanctions. I talked to NGOs in India who are up in arms saying, you know, what is Sierra Club telling us? You know, they don't listen to us. These, you know, they have lots of money. We have very little money.
But everybody likes a standard of living that they've come to imagine they're entitled to in the United States and a certain kind of environmental cleanliness. Jagdish Bhagwati, stand by. I want to begin to welcome our callers in here.
Lovely,
Eddie's calling from Westford, Massachusetts. Hi, Eddie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great, thanks.
This is a great show.
Thanks, Eddie.
I worked at Polaroid.
Okay.
And then Polaroid decided that they were going to send a lot of our production to Mexico. They were going to send some of it to China.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to send some of it to Scotland. And before you know it, there was nothing here in this country. Then, as most people are aware, Polaroid went under.
Yep.
And the people that had been having money taken out of their pay to purchase stock in the company at $31.88,
worthless.
When the company went bankrupt,
mm-hmm.
they lost it. Their stock was sold for 9 cents a share.
So, Eddie, how's globalization working for you these days?
I was never for it. I'm still not for it because right now I'm in my 60s and I'm working a job in a QC lab that pays me a little bit over $10 an hour.
A quality control lab, just over $10 an hour. And that's what that's how you see the fruits of free trade.
Mark has hit it right on the – he hit the nail right on the head, okay? Mark, I agree with everything that he has said so far.
But Eddie, don't you also see the benefits of free trade all around us? I mean, there are other countries that can produce lots of goods more cheaply than the United States, and you're probably shopping for those these days.
Well, you know, I tell you, I own an American vehicle. I would not buy a foreign vehicle. If it says made in America, I buy it. And you really don't understand it
mm-hmm.
until you're in this position. And, you know, it was funny because last week in the paper, there was a picture of Senator Kerry, and he was down, I think it was in South Carolina or
yes.
North Carolina, with that plant closed.
Mm-hmm.
And it showed him sitting at a table with this woman, and the woman was telling the story about how she was going to lose her job going overseas. And Senator Kerry, it showed him with a tear in his eye. But you know something? He never had a tear in his eye for any of the constituents that vote for him up here in Massachusetts. We haven't heard word one from him.
Yeah, well, we wonder. But we hear your story loud and clear, and I want to get a response to it. Eddie, thanks for your call. Jagdish Bhagwati, of course, competition means displacement, and it means lives
can be
put into a tumble. But here's an American citizen who says, wow, this doesn't feel like it's working for me.
And then, I think what we need is, and it's something which the Republicans were not very good at retaining because it wasn't working too well, but ever since President Kennedy's time, we've had a series of adjustment assistance programs. And every trade bill we pass, everybody sort of, you know, tries to come up with some further innovation, like the last fast-track authority bill, which
mm-hmm.
was given, you know, which gave authority to the President Bush to negotiate
right.
Doha. So I think, you know, there are no really libertarian free traders. I said probably are, but I certainly not want
to. In other words, don't make the worker who loses his job bear all the pain individually. Have some programs to help him out.
You have to assist them, like this gentleman who comes from Massachusetts, where I taught at MIT for years. Polaroid Edwin Land was from MIT as
of course.
Well.
But look, here's the question.
A story which, you know, one should not take lightly.
But here's the question coming up beneath that, Professor Bhagwati. When we heard IBM saying we've got to move white collar jobs abroad, and suddenly Americans, I think, are wondering what is left for us if we're not making, you know, the bath towels, and we're not making the computer chips, and we're not even staffing the ranks of IBM. Then no amount of government program is going to fix that.
Well, I think what would happen then is, what you're suggesting is that somehow our exchange rate is out of whack and we're not going to be able to export anything. I don't think that's a possibility unless, you know, you're grossly overvalued in your exchange rate. There's always it just doesn't make sense to say that this will happen for every activity in the system. There, you know, other people are buying our goods.
Right.
They're creating jobs. And as I said, along Route 95, where we lost some textile jobs, a lot of capital-intensive, high-yield jobs did come in, which were much better. So I think but none of this is to deny this gentleman his anguish and the necessity to help him, which is really worth, I think every good system does. And I think one of the reasons why to return to Doha rather than focus just on us and to Cancun, because and the anti-globalizers there who are now, you know, many of them are Mexican and so on. I think they worry that when their leaders go in for freer trade, often of their own volition, not necessarily pushed by anybody, because they think, you know, excessive protection is bad for them, and they would like to reduce it. It's not just our pressure.
Of course.
Then you see they don't have the money, and they don't to be able to finance these adjustment assistance programs. So while our friend from Massachusetts certainly must have been able to access some unemployment insurance, some trade adjustment assistance, very likely if he was losing job due to trade. We have nothing in India, nothing in Mexico, nothing in any of these countries. And I have been arguing for a long time that you're really asking poor countries, which were generally closed, which are opening up now because they felt, you know, they shot themselves in the foot with excessive protection, to really make this transition without any of the institutions we have built up over 50 years of liberalization.
So it's hard for everyone, but you're still confident at the bottom of all that it's good for everyone.
Oh, absolutely. I do. And this is why I think, you see, all the polls that you find, I don't mean people who are going to the streets and, you know, idealistic youth in many cases, but you really find poll after poll. Just last week there was this Pew poll, I think, which showed repeated support for liberalization. And even in NAFTA, remember, Tom, that while it was a tough fight, ultimately the government did win.
Yes, they did. Jagdish Bhagwati, Mark Weisbrot, please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking about the resurgent debate over the truth and consequences of global trade. You can join the conversation. Does a free trade universe have to mean that American living standards veer toward China's and India's? Would global labor standards, global environmental standards, keep free trade from becoming a race to the bottom, or would they just mess it up? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the battle cries of free trade and fair trade and a resurgent debate over the truth and consequences of global trade. Are you still on the free trade bandwagon, or are you running from free trade? Is your job threatened? Are you losing or keeping the faith? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Professor Jagdish Bhagwati, joining us from New York. He's professor of economics and political science at Columbia University. And from Washington, Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Right now, Bob is on the line from Boston. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Thank you for having me on. I've got actually one comment and perhaps a question from your guest.
Let's hear it.
I don't know if the whole premise of this discussion is correct, because what's happened over the last 20 to 30 years is that the people in the third world, their income, the average income, has been dropping dramatically. People are earning probably half to a third of what they did 20 years ago in most countries in the third world. That's their purchasing power in order to be able to buy goods that are produced in the West or produced in their own countries.
So are you saying stop griping Americans, the third world has got it a lot tougher on the globalization front? Is that your point, Bob?
I think a lot of these terms that are used nowadays, free trade, WTO, etc., are just fallacies, are just made up terms for the very powerful companies that, unfortunately, most of the Western governments are at their behest. And there are lots and lots of examples of these. I would recommend anybody who hasn't read this book to read Amy Chua's book called World on Fire.
Yes, we've talked about it. We've talked about it on this show, Bob. But our time is short. Let me take that right there. Mark Weiss brought to Bob's central point. Has globalization worked for the developing world? We certainly see rising standards of living in any number of countries.
No, absolutely not. It's not quite as
India,
bad as
China.
Bob said. India and China are the exceptions. That's only two countries. They have a lot of people, but if you're looking at the policies, you have to look at all the countries that have liberalized over the last 20 years. And if you look at everyone, it's been a terrible failure. And just in terms of growth, I mean, that's the most simple statistic you can look at. You know, how much has income per person grown? And, you know, from 1960 to 1980 in Latin America, for example, it grew by 75%. And since they've opened up since 1980, it's grown by about 7%. So you have this drastic slowdown in growth in the vast majority of developing countries.
Jagdish Bhagwati, do you agree with that?
It really failed for them.
Do you agree
with
that interpretation, Jagdish?
It's the interpretation that I disagree with. Mark is absolutely right about the facts. But I think India and China, you can't dismiss them because that's a hell of a lot of the world's population.
But we can't dismiss Latin America either, right?
I mean, that's where the poverty was immense, and we've had really dramatic change ever since. Opening up and other measures, not just opening up, has contributed to substantial acceleration of the growth rate and then pulling up of the, you know, unemployed and underemployed into gainful employment. But take that aside, but you take Africa. I mean, it's regressed, most definitely. Mark is right. But that's, you know, it's due to internal warfare, bad governance at a variety of levels, and those sort of problems which we are continuously struggling with. And that's another story, and that's going to be our real challenge in development, how to fix that. And I think there, too, we have to ask Mark, when he was so skeptical, if he had not had even the slight opening, and if he had closing instead.
Closing of markets, that is.
Would things have been better?
Can I answer that?
Yes, please, Mark Weisbrot.
When you take Latin America, let me just complete South America, which also I think is absolutely right. The only country which really opened up and maintained good macroeconomics was Chile. It registered very high growth rate. You take the rest of most of South America, the macro policies were so bad that really everything got really totally unhinged.
Let's pick that up. So you're saying they're just not picking up the globalization medicine. Mark Weisbrot.
No, I mean, that's really not fair. You can't just pick a handful of countries, you know, out of 100 and say, you know, you've had a couple of success stories and everybody else has failed, and therefore they're the only ones that did it right. I mean, they all did different things. I mean, they all followed what we call the Washington Consensus to varying degrees. They opened up their trade. They reduced barriers to trade. They reduced barriers to investment, to capital inflows and outflows as well. And it has failed terribly. Now, if you look at
India and China, you've got half the developing world.
Let me explain that for just one moment. You know, first of all, India and China have still among the most protected markets in the world. And if you look at India, their growth spurt started about 10 years before they actually lowered their tariffs.
Yes, the
same is true for China as well. So these are the countries who have a state-owned, you know, country. I mean, China has a state-owned banking system. They have the tightest currency controls in the world. So these are countries that, sure, they increased their trade share, but they didn't do it in the way that the WTO or the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank or Washington in general tried to impose on the rest of the world.
Not by free trade.
So it's not as if countries can't benefit from trade, but they need to use trade for their own benefit and not just open up in the way that Washington wants them to open up.
Let's get another caller in here, Mark and Jagdish. Charles is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Good to have you.
I was a former member of the IBU in Chicago, 134. But what I'm calling about, I'm not so much concerned about NAFTA, was that my wife actually worked at Motorola and lost her job because Motorola was ending up giving more and more work to India, and where they could pay someone basically a quarter of her salary. And we ended up moving to Wisconsin, where she ended up getting a fine job. But it was pretty depressing that all of a sudden, you know, it's here's a worldwide company that they're cutting people back and paying people a lot less to do the work that she was doing, and literally working 60 to 70 hours a week to do this job.
And yet, Charles, you know, because we've all been pickled in it for decades now, all the arguments for free trade and many of the advantages are obvious of trade between nations and each country, you know, doing the thing it can do most efficiently and best. Where are you coming out in 2003, bottom line? Are you willing to see protectionist walls go up? You know what happened? You know, there was the Great Depression when that happened in the late 20s. Or are you just skeptically still along for the ride? Where do you stand?
Well, I'm actually kind of on the skeptical side because I just feel that our government, and I include the Democrats as well as the Republicans in with this, is that we're going to cut this country short in order to get to the bottom line. What's the cheapest thing that we can find? What's the cheapest thing that we can buy? And the same thing, I live in Wisconsin now. It's the same thing with the farmers. You know, we can't even export our agricultural goods without a huge tariff.
And yet there's a huge subsidy there as well. But Charles, thanks so much for your call. Jagdish Bhagwati, here's Howard Dean on Sunday night. He said in the Democrats debate, we ought not to be in the business of having free and open borders with countries that don't have the same environmental, labor, and human rights standards. And if you do that, we're going to be able to create manufacturing jobs in America again, and they'll stay in America. Is this a voice for a healthy planetary economy or for protectionism?
No, I think he badly needs a good advisor. I mean, you shouldn't be making statements which really are not going to be helpful if you ever get into power, which I hope you will, being a Democrat myself. But I think the real problem here is, let me give you just an example. Suppose one country is environmentally as committed as we are, okay, in some generic sense.
Committed environmentally, yeah.
Right. I mean, they're not anti-environmentalists, you know. They would like to clean up the air, clean up the water.
Yep.
But they have limited resources, just like we have. We don't have endless resources, nor do they. But if they have a lot of clean air and a lot of dirty water, like, say, Mexico does, except for Mexico City, because, you know, and we have it exactly in reverse, because we have tons of cars, and all our kids carry around little water bottles in their backpacks, and we have ways of dealing with it through water filters and God knows what else.
Our time is short. Take us to the bottom line of that story.
The bottom line is that they will want to do something for their industries, which are really, where air is more important, or rather water is more important. Mm-hmm. We will have environmental standards which are stricter for air pollution, for instance. Now, therefore, you will not see the same industry having the same tax burdens or same polluter tax burdens.
And back around, we come. Our time has run out, but I hear the bottom line there being let the market sort it out. There's going to be a lot of debate on that front in the next week in Cancun, in the next year in the campaign. Professor Jagdish Bhagwati at Columbia, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, Senator Joe Biden criticizes President Bush's handling of the war on terror. This is On Point. Two years ago, on the eve of the September 11th attacks, Delaware Senator Joseph Biden presciently told the National Press Club that, quote, the real threat comes to this country in the hold of a ship, the belly of a plane, or smuggled into a city in the middle of the night in a vial, in a backpack. Biden was back at the press club today. In a speech there, he welcomed George Bush's new willingness to work with the United Nations on Iraq. But he criticized the president for what he called misplaced priorities as the nation fights the war on terror. Here are excerpts from Senator Biden's speech.
Just as we operated under a misplaced set of priorities in foreign policy prior to 9/11, the days after the tragedy represented the first of many squandered opportunities by this administration. Rather than readjusting his priorities to meet the new harsh realities he faced, and God knows he faced a set of challenges no president has faced, and in many ways he faced them very well, but he did not adjust any of his priorities. These squandered opportunities, in my view, persist today here at home and beyond our borders, driven by a domestic ideological imperative of the devolution of government, that the federal government has no function but the national defense, resulting in a perverse notion that at the very moment we're worried about terror on our shores and on our neighborhood, we have cut by 40% aid to local law enforcement, that we have failed to fund by as much as $100 billion, according to the Council on New York Council on Foreign Relations report published by a Republican named Rudman, Homeland Defense. We've shortchanged it by, they say, $100 billion. I'd like to know how local government is capable on its own of dealing with these new security needs that we have at home. Here at home, we've squandered an opportunity to rally Americans to produce a national policy and a rational policy to achieve energy security, to wean us off of dependence on foreign oil, to ask Americans to make significant investments in alternative energy, solar panels in their homes, more fuel-efficient cars. Imagine if the President of the United States had said, in the wake of this, I challenge all of you who are able to do it in the construction of a new home to build into that home solar energy. It will cost you approximately 4% more to do that. But I ask you to do it. Imagine what the response would have been. I believe we squandered the opportunity to rally Americans to build a more effective homeland defense, to provide first responders with everything they need, like dependable communication equipment, state-of-the-art computers. I think we squandered the opportunity to make our borders and ports safer, our transportation systems more secure. Right as I speak, today there will be 350,000 people sitting in a train car underneath the city of New York City, going through the Baltimore Tunnel. Remember they had a little fire in the Baltimore Tunnel about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago? It shut down Baltimore. That tunnel was built in 1869. There is no ventilation, no escape, no lighting in those tunnels. We have the engineering done to let contracts for $900 million to deal with that issue. That would, I might note parenthetically, put people to work, increase our productivity, and enhance our security. But why is it that the priorities I've mentioned have not been funded? Well, I would suggest to you that it's a continued adherence to another ideological construct, to allow them to preserve the rationale for a huge tax cut that in the end, when all is said and done, will approach about $1 trillion.
Delaware Democratic Senator Joseph Biden speaking earlier today at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.